the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jonathan Larson.
And I am one of your other hosts, Jody Green.
And I'm the third host, Michael Scavarla.
And we are super pumped to be back in the studio recording for you and making another entomological episode for you. We took a little break here recently and kind of been trying to catch up on things this summer. It's been a very, very busy summer, I think, for all three of us in regards to entomology. Lots of questions, lots of problems. But now we're slowly transitioning into fall. Jody even has an interesting anecdote about she was out shopping the other day and saw Halloween decorations that were a little entomological, right?
Yes. Well, I always have to stop and look at anything that's got scary insect or arthropod things. And so, you know, I get things on sale after Halloween. I got giant centipedes and I get all spider things and put them in my office and scare everyone. But last night, when we were at the hardware store at 10 o'clock.
Menards?
Yes. Yeah. We love Menards.
Menards. The greens so, always are at the Menards.
Yes. It's like the Walmart for what? It's like the Walmart for hardware.
I don't know.
In Canada, it would be Canadian Tire. Okay. To say. But we walked by the Halloween decorations, which probably just got starting to get set out. And there was this giant spider skeleton. An endoskeleton. So, of course, entomologist mom was like, what? And then my daughter, Taya, is like, grabs it, starts pulling it all the legs apart. And it's got...
It looked big.
It's huge. And it's like skeleton. Right. And it's got like a vertebrae, like a backbone going all the way down its abdomen and around. And so my family knows that irritates me. And then
I took a photo of something similar last year, and I think that's the most play I've ever gotten on Twitter was that picture when I put it up. So I think that I know a lot of entomologists are listening right now that are just, their blood is boiling, their hair is bristling at the idea of it. I think I saw Mike literally arch his back in anger at the thought of this Halloween decoration. So don't buy those. Don't support that industry. That's terrible.
You will see it. You will see it. I'm going to tweet it out.
You know what we should do, though? We should make our own Halloween decorations featuring insects that are exoskeletons, which can be terrifying in of themselves, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. The shells.
I don't even know if that's more scary.
It doesn't matter. We'll make a boodle. We'll make a bunch of them and we'll make a bunch of money, right, Mike?
What is a boodle?
A boodle. It's like a lot of something. A lot of money.
That's a term I've never heard.
Well, perhaps it's an Indiana term. Perhaps it's a Hoosierism.
This is going to be a boodle of fun where I'll stare at you like, what are you talking about?
It's a boodle of fun to be on the show with you today.
Isn't this a special show?
It is a special show. This is actually the 50th episode of Arthropod. It's only taken us 4 years to get to this point. I say us. Perhaps that's a little over-generous. I don't know. It's not you guys' fault that it's taken this long. But
no, but you did a lot of this. You did most of this on your own. Shout out to you.
I started back in 2014 doing this show, and I quit twice, I think, over the course of the last 4 years. Our friend Aaron Hodgson from Iowa State sent us an article recently that said that podcasts generally don't last more than, was it like 15 or 20 episodes? It was not a very long lifetime for most podcasts, and we have outlived that. And so is her show, which you should all go check out. We'll include it in the show notes. But there, when I first started, it was just me doing like monologues about insects, and my inspiration was sort of Dan Carlin, hardcore history style. I thought that I could do a shortened version of that, and I didn't have the confidence to handle that kind of workload. And so I quit. I didn't want to do it anymore. And then I did the three-segment version of Arthropod for a while, which was a pest profile, Entomology Today news segment, and then an interview. And then the feedback that I got after doing that for a while was that everybody just listened to the interviews. So I switched to doing that, just having interviews for a while. And then I felt like I'd run out of people to interview because nobody was responding to my emails. And I thought that maybe the show had lived its life. And so I quit again. But then I decided that I wanted to do it with you guys and that it would be a better show with three entomologists who are all zany in their own way. a boodle of zaniness, perhaps even.
I appreciate that.
And I'm really...
Sorry. I was just going to say, as much as I love hardcore history, I think we are putting out way more shows than they put out. So props. Props to you for keeping it going and getting more than one show out every 6 months.
It seems that we are doing a little bit better than Dan, but his shows are like 7 hours long. Maybe he'll mention us. I'm sure he's a listener. He's one of the... I think that this is cool. I'm really happy that you both agreed to do this and that you wanted to be on the show too. And I hope that it's been a fulfilling experience for both of you.
It's always the best part of my week. If I get to see Jonathan and Mike's face.
And virtual Mike.
Yes. I have a question.
I do enjoy it.
I have a question for each of you though. Do your spouses listen to the podcast?
Kara has listened to a couple of older episodes, but I don't know that she's listened to any of the latest stuff. How about you, Mike?
Heck no.
No?
Too many bugs in her life anyway?
No, it's not that. Like, she doesn't listen to this or the other podcasts I'm on, but she also doesn't listen to any podcasts. I suspect it's partly a generational thing. Like, they kind of got popular after she... I mean, she's slightly older than I am. But also, like, she's got two kids at home. She don't have time for that.
That's true.
It's true.
That's true. But we're glad that all of you are listening, and we're glad that if you've stuck it out with us from episode one, where I'm like, and insects are so cool, all the way up to episode 50. I'm looking forward to making 50 more, hopefully, in a shorter time span than 4 years.
So, let's shoot for 2 years.
Let's shoot for 2 years. I think that that's a good idea.
Yeah, 20, so.
That's 25 a year. That's just about 2 months. Yeah. So that's reasonable.
I think that is reasonable. So thanks for tuning in for our 50th episode with that sort of self-congratulation bit out of the way. I thought it would be a fun topic today to talk about cicadas. I get several questions about cicadas every year. I personally think that they're one of the cooler insects. I have a cicada lapel pin that I wear all the time. And I think that they're something that fascinate a lot of folks. I think that they're kind of a weird critter. And we have lots of people out there that are kind of interested in them. So I thought we'd feature an episode on this particular insect. And I thought we could start with our resident taxonomist, Dr. Michael Scavarla, perhaps elucidating us on what is a cicada exactly.
Sure. Cicadas, I'm going back to the email where we have the outline of this. And you asked regarding the taxonomy of cicadas, are they Homoptera or Hemiptera? For all of our listeners of a certain age, that came up about the time we came up, Homoptera was a group that was still in use. It is not valid anymore, so there's no Homoptera. Stop using it. Homoptera is a group, contains the two groups, a group of Sternorhynchia and Eukaryorhynchia. But we found, we used to think that they were very closely related because they kind of look the same. Turns out they're not. Each is its own kind of monophyletic lineage, but where they come out in the true bug family tree is still a bit debated, but they're not each other's closest relatives necessarily. So cicadas are Eukaryorhynchia. Sternorhynchia is the group that includes things like aphids and whiteflies, the plant parasitic bugs, and Eukaryorhynchia are the other... plant-feeding bugs. So cicadas, plant hoppers, tree hoppers, all of that group.
And what makes them unique as a group, if I may ask?
So the thing that makes Sternorhynchia and Eukaryorhynchia different from Heteroptera, the other group of true bugs, is that Heteroptera have... the wings have two different parts. They have a leathery part towards the front and a membranous part towards the back.
Okay.
And between Sternorhynchia and Eukaryorhynchia, the old Homoptera, Sternorhynchia have the beak, the piercing, sucking mouth parts, apparently come out between the forelegs. So if you think Sternorhynchia, sternum, the beak comes out on the sternum. And Eukaryorhynchia, the beak arises from the front of the head rather than between the legs.
Okay. So they have that piercing, sucking like mouth part, like all hemipterans do. But yep. In terms of specialization, theirs may arise in a different, or be hidden in a different portion of their body.
Yeah. So, in a lot of the reason it comes out from the front of the head is because they've got a large modified clypeus, so they've got a lot of extra muscles in the front of the head,
okay.
And they use those extra muscles to form a sidereal pump, which they use to suck plant juices. So they've got a lot of extra musculature at the front of the head in order to suck more plant juices more efficiently.
If you were to say what a clypeus is analogous to on a human being, what would you argue it is?
I mean, it's kind of like a nose. It's at the front of the head.
Okay, kind of like a nose, upper lip sort of situation.
Yeah, we don't really have an analogous part to it.
Jody is pantomiming it over here.
I'm like, where would that
be? It'd be right here in the smelly part or the part with a mustache, I would
your
argue.
Your sinuses?
Yeah, maybe.
In your upper lip without your nose?
Yes.
Sort of similar.
Yeah, so imagine that the front part of your face is large and expanded and full of muscles, and then you use that to suck up juices through a straw.
They would have mighty sneezes, is what we're trying to say. So they have piercing, sucking mouth parts. Their wings are all the same. They don't have the front leathery part, right? Like
right.
Some
so
of the other.
They've got membranous wings throughout. They've got two pairs of membranous wings.
And if you were to describe cicadas further, what are some physical attributes about their head in particular that are kind of noticeable?
Well, definitely, again, that enlarged clypeus. They have large eyes. Cicadas, as a rule, are pretty big, much larger than many of the other Eukaryota, at least that we get in the United States. Now, when you go to other parts of the world, there are large tree hoppers and plant hoppers and things. But in the United States, they're the biggest.
Like, I would say, like, if you were a bird or a predator, that would be a pretty good juicy meal. Like, that...
Even if you're a person.
I mean, yeah. Okay, so... Yes, entomophagist. So, yeah, it's a good meal. Like, when you're like, that's a hearty, juicy type of bug, right?
They're an absolute unit, is what we're
saying.
And
I think, well,
large.
And so when I look at them, like, I don't know if people think... they kind of remind me of a pug, if I were to say. Like,
oh, okay.
Because their eyes are so far apart, right?
Yeah.
But then... Right? And then I have the picture of the cutest cicada in Nebraska. Can we put that in the show notes?
Absolutely.
It was the cutest cicada I've ever seen in my whole
life.
Did
it win
a
contest? Or?
No, but I didn't enter it into a contest.
Okay.
I don't know if they have baby
contests. We should have cicada contests, yeah.
Okay, let's all later.
I like the pug analogy.
You know, because their eyes are separate, but they do have that triangle of eyes.
Yeah, and I like their grill. I like the mouth as well. What we would look at
their
as
grill.
The mouth. I think it looks like Darth Vader's mouthpiece, kind of. They kind of have that sort of similar appearance.
Like stormtrooper-ish?
Yeah, a little stormtroopery. Wide eyes with a big sort of grill-looking mouth part there in front. I know it's not their actual mouth, but...
This should be on a video, the way we're, like, making our faces.
But they are large. They have big eyes. These are all things that help to separate them from the other hemipterans and some of their other cousins. I've always thought it was fascinating that an aphid and a cicada are so closely related, that they're essentially cousins, because there's just such a big difference between those two critters that it's hard to believe that they're related. But you could say that about any insect, right? A mantid versus a cicada versus a butterfly versus a cockroach. So they are really fascinating looking creatures. If you were to describe their fossil record, when did they first arise?
Oh, man. So this is kind of cool. Cicada morphs, so the larger group that includes crown group cicadas, the ones that are still alive today, and then all of their relatives throughout time, plus the things related to cicadas, so plant hoppers, leaf hoppers, that kind of thing. Cicada morphs go way back to pre-dinosaurs.
Okay.
They are an absolutely ancient group, and so... They predate the rise of angiosperm flowering plants, so they were feeding on things like ferns and cycads and all of those kind of primitive plants. And the earliest records are from the late Permian.
Cool.
And so that's cicada morphs. So that's, again, things like cicadas, leaf hoppers, tree hoppers, spittle bugs. So that group is a larger group, is ancient. Cicadas proper then jump in sometime in the middle Jurassic, early Jurassic, we've got fossils from. But even those aren't, for the most part, the cicadas that we have today. So there's two groups of cicadas that are alive. The true cicadas, which is the vast, vast majority of the thousands of species that we have, and then hairy cicadas, which comprises two species in Tasmania and southern Australia. So the hairy cicadas are the more primitive group. They're what pop up in the fossil record for the most part in the Jurassic and Triassic. They were widespread at one point. We have fossils from France, China, South America. And then after the dinosaurs went extinct, the true cicadas, the family Cicadidae, what comprises the vast majority of species today, arose sometime in the Paleocene.
Okay.
And so with that, then all of the hairy cicadas kind of went extinct through time. So we've got just two left, again, restricted to Tasmania and southern Australia. And then the true cicada is what is alive today. For the most part, came up in the Paleocene. So 60 million years ago or so.
Awesome. And if we were to talk more about why we are talking about cicadas, why do people care about these? What are some things about them that fascinate us or horrify us, do you think?
I think it's because they're big and loud. But, I mean, they make a lot of noise. They're very conspicuous for insects. People like making music, so we kind of have that association between the noise they make and our own music that we make. And they're big.
They are big.
Yeah.
We see them.
They're very conspicuous.
They're around. People can ignore a lot of things or pretend they don't exist when they don't like bugs or insects or arthropods or anything. But then you see them, you hear them, you see evidence that they're emerging. They're loud. They're ruining your conversation. You know, like
the sounds of summer are the sounds of cicadas trying to have intercourse.
Yeah, that probably disturbs people too.
It does a little bit. I think that one of the things I've always thought cicadas were neat. Even when I was a kid, I liked collecting the shells. I liked seeing them. I thought they were just a really fascinating looking creature. But I was always told a lot of wrong information about them. I was always told the wrong name about them. In particular, I don't know about you two, but when I was growing up, everybody I knew called cicadas katydids.
Ooh. Oh.
That's where I'm from. Really? People call them katydids.
Hmm.
Yes. My grandpa, I remember distinctly, he'd say, "Do you hear the katydids in the trees?" And I've always thought that was kind of odd because a katydid is its own distinct organism. I assume that that's partially because they both make noise.
What did they call katydids?
I don't know if they know what katydids are or if they would know that there's a difference there.
Oh, because I know people call katydids leaf bugs. Like I found a leaf bug and I wanted to show you. And then I'm like, that's a katydid.
Yeah, maybe that's part of it there too.
But that's not what I thought you were going to say about
cicadas. What did you think I was going to say?
I thought you were going to say they're locusts because someone actually, a master gardener, said that to me the other day. Like, oh, look at the locusts.
What do you call them, Mike?
I've always heard them called cicadas.
Always.
It wasn't until I moved to Indiana for my undergrad that I heard anybody ever call them a locust.
Really?
I wonder if that's a more Midwest thing.
I would say 60% of people who see them, they're, oh, there's a locust. Or I hear those locusts. When are those locusts coming back?
So why do you think they refer to them as locusts? I mean, that's wrong too, right?
That's wrong.
That's just as wrong as Katie did.
Why is it wrong though, Mike?
Because katydids and locusts are in the order Orthoptera, so they're related to crickets and grasshoppers and those things. Yeah. And they have chewing mouth parts, and they are not at all related to cicadas, which are true bugs, which have piercing sucking mouth parts.
And locusts are even really, they're fascinating in their own right as a gregarious morph of some of our different grasshoppers where there's too many of them in the general vicinity of each other. And from what I remember, they rub a special hair on each other's legs on accident. And if it happens enough times, they undergo an adult molt where they then change color and become more aggressive. And then they begin feeding and eating on everything and mating a lot more. And they want all of the resources that they can get. So locusts are a plague, right? That's what we talk about with them most often is that they're a biblical plague. They destroy lives. We used to have a locust here in America, the Rocky Mountain locust.
I'm so sad we don't anymore.
You might be one of the few. I know that here in Nebraska, that is part of the local lore, that there used to be these locusts that would come through and destroy the crops down in Kansas as well. But it's no longer around, seemingly. And I've always thought it was really neat. Gene Kritsky, in his book about periodical cicadas, he talks a little bit about perhaps the reason this misnomer arose is that when the colonizers from the old world arrived here in the Americas, there's a theory that maybe they arrived, some of them arrived at least, during a periodical cicada emergence. And if you saw that many bugs in one area and you were a Bible-reading Puritan, you may also believe that you have walked into a biblical plague of locusts.
That's true.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense.
Yeah, because if I showed up in, you know, Sarpy County in 2015 and to our brood here, right. Yeah, I would have gone back to Indiana.
It's a lot of bugs all at once. And it's a very special event when that happens, when periodical cicadas emerge. But so if there's periodical cicadas and there are annual cicadas, what are some of the differences there, Jody?
So, as the name implies, annual cicadas come out every year. So they are a different species. And a lot of times, if you don't know much about cicadas, you'll just assume they're the same ones. And not, just because they're in that certain state doesn't mean they're in that county. So they're very specific, and we call those broods. And these periodical cicadas, what is so cool about them is they come out every 13 or 17 years, which are pretty wild and wacky numbers because, Well, if anyone knows much about math, and I actually don't, but these are prime numbers. So they are not like divisible by anything but themselves and one. And so this 13 and 17 year, it's actually like an evolutionary strategy for predators and prey. So those years, like, it's not just a lot. It's like millions and billions. And there's actually a really cool set of maps if you want to know what brood is in your state or what's coming up. I know for like 2018, it was a brood in New York State. Here in they call it the Kansas brood, and it's like Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. And it's not like throughout the whole state, just little pockets, but they emerge in like mass numbers. It's
a big
incredible
deal.
Like, you can't go, they're on you, so holes in the ground, exoskeletons everywhere. But I guess we should actually talk about like how they develop, right? So a lot of times, most of their life is spent underground, even the annual ones. So their lifespans, they're like the longest living
insect
in North America, believe, right? But they spend most of their life underground. So like, I think it's 2 to 21 years or something like that. So what they do is, so where do we start? The egg or the nymph?
So there's eggs that are laid in the tree.
In the tree branch or cracks.
The female cuts a slit in the branch and then puts her egg capsule into the branch. It hatches.
And they emerge, and you said they actually look like termites. They're white little nymphs, and they'll feed. And so they do feed on tree sap, plant sap. They fall to the ground, and then they go dig underground and feed on tree roots and sap and go from like grass roots, like wherever their plant sap at that stage of life. But those periodical cicadas, they actually can spend like their instars or each stage like years at a time. So underneath the ground, the periodical cicadas, let's say the 17-year cicada, they're underground for all those years.
Right.
And the annual cicada, you know, they're underground for less time, but that species comes out every year. It's a huge, but it's pretty normal. Like, I don't.
Well, that's an important point to bring up, I think, is that an annual cicada does not necessarily have an annual life cycle. There are annual cicadas every summer, but even those nymphs have to feed underground for multiple years, 2 to 3, maybe even 4 years under the soil, feeding on the tree roots.
But they emerge each year. The periodical ones come out together. Like, they will wait for each other and come out like a mass hysteria of like zombies coming out of the ground. So the nymphs crawl their way out, and they've got these specialized front legs that are like digging claws, and they dig their way out, and they usually climb up the first tree. But, I mean, right now they're still emerging, and they're on mailboxes, on tables. They can be on anything. And they crawl up, and then they will emerge as adults, so their last molt. And that's what people are finding. So they see those exoskeletons there, and sometimes, you know, they're lucky enough to actually see a newly emerged cicada trying to harden and, you know,
take to the tops of the trees.
Yeah. But
so it's a pretty cool life cycle the way they develop. I think there's always lots of discussion about why does it take them so long, and I would imagine part of it is if you fed on nothing but sugar water for your whole life, it might take you a long time to grow up as well. It's like feeding your kid Mountain Dew mixed with Dr. Pepper every morning and hoping that they grow up strong and healthy. It's not a very nutritious diet, per se.
And people always ask, like, well, how do they know that? So
how do they know when to emerge?
It's some internal clock and the environmental cues, so they can sense the seasons and the changes in the trees and the sap and whatnot. But it's the 64 degree Fahrenheit temperature at about 8 inches deep but that year that they're due to emerge. And I think it was a couple years ago, it was like a big thing that one brood emerged like 4 years early.
Here in Nebraska, we had an interesting phenomenon where there were some that came out a year early, I remember, and then some that came out a year late, which this was happening down in Fontenelle Forest. And there was some interest in figuring out why they were doing that, if they were splitting, or if this is a common evolutionary strategy amongst periodical cicadas. So say a flood happened in the actual 17th year that you were supposed to emerge. If there were still some hidden underground, perhaps you could emerge the next year and start essentially a new brood. That was kind of the leading theory that I had heard about back in 2015. Have you ever heard of anything like that, Mike?
I've definitely heard of them being a year early or a year late, and that can lead to brood splitting eventually. It's not uncommon, I don't think.
And we have several broods across the United States. They all have Roman numeral names. If you want to see those maps, mm-hmm. we'll include them in the show notes. We've had some lost broods over mm-hmm. the course of history that we've been studying this. There's a really cool website called Cicada Mania, and we'll probably link to that a lot in the show notes because they have a lot of the history and exploration of periodical cicadas, a little bit on annual cicadas as well.
Well, the annual and then periodical. So there's like 3,000 different species. There are a lot of species of cicadas, and they're distributed like worldwide, maybe except Antarctica. But there are 7 periodical, and 3 of those are the 17-year, and 4 of those species are 13-year cicadas.
And what's their genus name?
Magic cicada. It's cool. But you can tell the difference, and it kind of creeps people out. So besides there being millions of them, the cicadas that are periodical typically have black bodies and bright red eyes and orange veins for their wings. And so they look very different, and they're a little bit smaller. Actually, they're a lot smaller. They're not as good as a meal, but you have so many.
So many of them, yeah. Have you ever been in the middle of an emergence, Mike?
I have not. There was one down in Arkansas, like 20 miles away from where I lived when I was down there, and I didn't make it out, unfortunately. The only thing I'd add to the species of periodical cicadas is I think the neat part there is the closest relatives or of each of the 17 and 13 year species are the associated 17 and 13 year old species. So each 17 year species, the 3 of them, has an associated 13 year species, and that's that species' closest relative. So it looks like the 13 and 17 year species have split 3 times independently into separate species.
Oh, wow.
Cool.
Except for one of the 17-year species that has split twice into 2 13-year species.
Okay.
Wow.
Which is, like, 3 independent events of that happening is really weird and cool.
That is cool.
And I think, people can identify them by their markings, their colors, but the sounds that they make. So I think that's one of the biggest deals about cicadas is that they're a visual, like, amazing thing, but their audio, like, yeah. It's overwhelming.
They would make good podcasters.
They would just be yelling, though.
The annual cicadas, it's often easier to identify them by sound, which is a really cool topic in and of itself. That's, you know, most cicada species only call during certain parts of the day. I like to link cicada sound blindness to plant blindness. Like, you go into the forest and you just see the green wall of plants.
Yeah.
But once you know what they are, like, you can pick them out and you know what everything is. And once you learn cicada songs, you really like going through the day, you're like, oh, this species is out now, and that species is out later, and this species is out right at dusk. And instead of just being background noise, you start to pick out, like, all the different things around you.
And it's a really cool way of making sound. When we think of most insect auditory cues, we're talking about stridulation, where they rub one part of their body on another to create a chirp or a different kind of noise that they want to make to attract each other or to warn one another. This is an insect, though, that has a large timble muscle. The males are able to flex it and click it when it goes in and out. And they have a largely hollow body cavity in their abdomen, so the sound reverberates inside of them. And then it can escape through the spiracles, and that even amplifies it even more. So it sounds to us like this long-winded, sort of grinding, high-pitched noise. But in reality, it's a series of really quick clicks with this timble muscle. And if you catch a cicada and you kind of peel its wing up and look at the side of its body, you can see their timble muscle, where they're using what they're using to make that click. They also can hear with their they have a tympanum that they're able to hear with. And from what I've read, the male can somehow shield his tympanum so it doesn't get harmed by his own sound production. Because we're talking about one of the loudest insects, I think we're talking like 120 decibels. If you were to hold it next to your ear and they were to trill the way they do, you could experience some hearing loss afterwards. It's not a good thing to just listen to them like you would with headphones on. They are really loud. So they need to shield themselves when they're making that sound. But the male makes the noise in order to attract other males to the tree. There's a call usually where it's like, hey, fellas, let's get together. Let's get the band going. Then everybody comes to the tree and then they produce an even louder chorus, which then is supposed to attract females to that tree so that courtship can begin. There's a courtship call, and we're going to put little audio bits of these here in between each of the talking points. But so there's a call. Chorus. A courtship call.
What does the female call back, or is
the female doesn't produce a noise like we associate with cicadas? She can make a wing flick, which is an acceptance of a male as a paramour, as a mating partner, and then that's a signal that mating can begin.
Click, click. Okay.
That he can hear, but I don't think that we're really able to hear her wing click that she responds with. So this is all about making more cicadas. That's why they're making all that noise. And I know that it bothers some people to hear that noise, right, Jody?
Oh my gosh. I love it. To me, that is the sound of summer. I grew up in Ontario, Canada. That is the sound of summer. I lived close to the wooded area. That it's not summer without cicadas. So it's hard when I get calls like, how do I get those things to stop? It's irritating me and it's bothering me. It's ruining my night, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like,
move to the moon.
Yeah, it's like, well, I mean, it won't be around for much longer.
Yeah, I would say there's no treatment for cicadas.
Right.
Yeah, so there's nothing that you can spray that's going to stop them. There's nothing that you can do.
If you've got trees nearby.
Yeah, if you got rid of all the trees that you live nearby, or you paved all the ground so they couldn't come up out of the soil, maybe.
But even that's not necessarily true, because there's a bunch of species that live on grass roots and not tree roots, depending on where you go in the country.
Yeah. It's inescapable. And I'm sorry that it bothers you, but it's just part of living on planet Earth, really.
Earplugs.
Earplugs, or you get adjusted to it. You get accustomed to it after a while where you just don't hear it anymore. But there are other problems that we associate with them.
Yeah. So some people... go ahead.
If I could break in and just one thing real quick. So the family cicadidae, the one that's everywhere, have the tympanum. The hairy cicadas, that relic group, they don't. And apparently other cicadas didn't. So the whole singing chorus of cicadas is a reasonably recent thing 60 million years ago. But if you were to go back at the time of the dinosaurs, you wouldn't hear it because none of them called like that.
Cool.
So if you ever go back to the Cretaceous, like that sound, you won't hear cicadas calling.
You would hear other sounds, probably.
You could hear others. I hope so.
Let's probably go back to the Cretaceous.
Your own voice screaming into the ether as you're eaten by a dinosaur.
Probably for cicadas.
So they make that sound to me. It does annoy some people. There's also some damage that's occasionally associated with cicadas. We mentioned before that the female lays her eggs in slits that she cuts in tree branches. So during the periodical emergence, we can see flagging in trees. There are so many slits that are cut that smaller branches can snap and flag downward, which is actually sort of a strategy, if I remember correctly, for them to get the branch to fall to the ground so that their nymphs don't have as far to go to get into the soil. And that can be unsightly. They love oak trees. It's one of their favorite egg-laying sites, but they don't have a lot of fidelity when it comes to hosts. They will choose just about any fruit tree, oak tree, any long-lived species, obviously. They need it to be around for a while. So they're going to pick that tree, lay their eggs in it. You can see that flagging. It's bronze spots in an otherwise green canopy, or you might see bits of branches falling out. But ultimately, it's not going to kill a mature tree. A young, newly transplanted tree, maybe you do need to worry about. And you can put some netting over it, right, Jody?
Yeah, so it's like plastic netting, quarter inch. Attach that around the tree.
Yeah. Don't let any branches stick out from the netting because otherwise they're going to use it. But you want to make sure that those holes are small enough that the cicadas can't crawl through there. You're just trying to stop the female from getting on the tree. No insecticides, though, really are needed to control this particular situation. I thought we could end by talking a little bit about some of the relationships, but the positive relationships that they have with humans, not just the fascination that so many of us have. I know a lot of kids get introduced to entomology by collecting cicada shells. That's something we've seen pictures of people with them attached to their face or their shirts.
Yeah, my son or daughter collected a bunch of them and they're using them like in the place of Barbies. You know, they have a whole...
That's cool.
Yeah, a whole, you know, whatever.
I don't have
colony.
Legos.
I want to say colony. A whole family of friends of cicada shells.
And that's kind of neat.
But yeah, I mean, there's so many questions about it and you can learn so much about life cycle. I had someone tweet me last night and said, the kids have so many questions. I'm like, send them my way.
Yeah.
I would be happy to answer them because I do think it's like a gateway into... Wow, molting, exoskeleton, wings, like, and when they find the cicada hanging upside down, like after it's, you know, pumped all the fluids through its body to emerge, like it splits. It's actually pretty creepy, I guess, if you're not a bug lover and you see like this thing, its back opening and like coming out right. of its shell and then drying off and then flying away.
Looks a little bit like alien, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many great time-lapse videos of that happening. It's truly amazing.
It is amazing. Right?
Actually, we met because of periodical cicadas.
That's true. We re-met here in Nebraska because of periodical cicadas. We both were at Fontenelle when they were coming out.
But they weren't there. So I left
right.
and I went and we found them. Yeah.
I was part of a hike at Fontenelle Forest. I was supposed to hike people through the woods and we were going to look at all the periodical cicadas and there weren't any. It's kind of embarrassing. No.
And then I got a call. It's like, what are these things coming out at SRAM? And I'm like, I'm going to be right there. So I drove 45 minutes. They were coming up by hundreds. I think today was four and they were everywhere. We had her touching them. It was amazing. Like it really introduced her to bugs in a big way. And now she's bug lover.
Bug lover. They are something that's featured in our culture for a long time. You can read Aristotle and Pliny the Elder talking about cicadas. I think it's Aristotle that he really liked to eat them. And if I remember correctly, he may even have a recipe for them in one of his works. Pliny the Elder describes figuring out what they are doing in the summer. I really like the idea of a time previous to knowing that cicadas are making that noise and everybody on Earth thinking that trees were just screaming every summer at one another. I think that was probably a funny time in history. They also feature in some of our myths and in some of our different folklore. In China, cicadas are often considered to be symbols of rebirth or immortality because it seems like they're always arising from the soil and they're always around. They don't disappear very quickly. There's a really cool Greek myth about Eos and her boyfriend, I guess, Titanus, who was a mortal. Eos is the goddess of the dawn, and she was in love with this mortal named Titanus. And she asked Zeus, she sort of requested from him if she could have immortality for Titanus. But she forgot to ask for eternal youth in addition to the immortality. So he became immortal, but then he became really, really mega old and couldn't really do much of anything. So she left him, and he just kept getting older and older until he shriveled up and became the first cicada that dug down into the soil. So that, I think that's kind of an interesting story, an interesting idea about how they maybe came around. There's another Greek story, folklore, a little bit about Eunomos and his kithara. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's a lyre. It's a stringed instrument, and he was playing it in a competition, and right as he was about to hit the last couple of notes, one of the strings broke. And then a cicada was like, this bro is pretty awesome, I'm going to help him out, and landed on his kithara and played the last two notes for him. And he won the competition and became quite famous afterwards. So they're used as a symbol of rebirth. They're used as a symbol of age. They're used as a symbol for creativity and song. I think that they've just become a really indelible part of many of our cultures. And I hope that you've enjoyed listening about them today and learning a little bit about these wonderful insects. And if you have any questions about them, you can always send them to us. You can find our website at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can leave comments there or find an email for the show. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at @JLarson_UNL.
I'm at @JodyBugsMeUNL.
I'm at @MScavarla36.
You can also find the show itself at @Arthro_pod show. And you can tweet us directly there and let us know what you'd like to learn about in future episodes. Let us know how we're doing. If you are listening to us on iTunes or any other podcatcher type app, we would appreciate a review or a subscription so that we can get to more and more of an audience. And we are excited that the next episode, the 51st episode of Arthropod, we're going to be talking about monarchs. So if you have any questions burning in your soul about monarch butterflies, please send them to us so that we can include them in that show. But we thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on buggin'.